This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome, everybody, to Fruit Loop Season 3, Episode 14. Thank you so much for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that we do not hear or know much about. Now, contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, cisgendered, white dudes. What? There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and whew, if anybody's watching the news, that Sam Little case.
Oh, yeah.
Fruit Loops is a podcast all about him. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers of color and true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news is racist, allegedly. But wink, wink, they are.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy. I'm Beth. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Mm-hmm. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294. And we may feature it on a future episode.
I gotta say, we need more voicemails.
Yeah, please. Please leave us a voicemail. Anything. Just say hi.
Yes. 602-935-6294. We won't answer, but we want to hear what you have to say and what you think.
Yeah. And if you don't want us to put it on the episode, then tell us and we won't do it.
Amen.
So, yes. Yeah. Leave us a voicemail. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And if you're not on Facebook, you can join the discussion on Twitter or Instagram by using the hashtag Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. Mm-hmm. All of the footnotes for each episode, which articles and other media that we use to source this story, the music notes, all of that stuff can be found on our website.
That's right. And if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Thank you so much to all of you who have done so.
Yes.
Which you can download to your phone, or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitLoopsPod, or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. We also have some merch for sale. Mom, what are you waiting for? Do you love me or not? On our website at fruitloopspod.com/merch. And if you cannot monetarily, no problem. You can always give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you get your podcasts from. And be sure to share our show with your friends. So, Beth, who are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about Craig Price, also known as the Warwick Slasher. He killed his first victim at the ripe old age of 13.
It's kind of interesting because he didn't do any slashing.
Stabbing.
Just a lot of... Well, I guess he did. Yeah,
he did some stabbing.
Okay. So we'll get into it. But in the meantime, how you doing?
I'm all right. We went to see Hustlers this weekend. That is you and me. So you know all about that.
We did. And we did. It was so fun.
Super fun. Yeah. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah. That is a great movie.
Yeah.
It's a very diverse cast. And J-Lo was really in her Latinx bag and her woman of color bag. And she had all the wonderful women of color included in the cast. Kiki, whatever her name is, Lizzo, Cardi B, who else was in there? Cardi B, Constance Wu. I mean,
oh yeah.
All of the way, like, it was very New York. Like, it would be weird to not to not see that see many women that of color in New York.
Cast.
Exactly. And so she did a great job. They're saying J-Lo's gonna get an Oscar for it or an Oscar nomination.
She was really good. She was really
she
good.
She was. Yeah. She really, really was. And oh man, I just
and she
enjoyed
looks
it so
fantastic.
Much. Oh my God. So she's like 50 something and she was wearing these outfits and like doing these strip teases. And I was like, oh, I was like whispering to Beth while we were watching it, like, she's not even wearing spigs. And look how good she, like, look how good she looks.
Yeah.
It's so unfair.
Great.
Oh my God.
But you know what? That's her job. So, I mean, you know.
That is her job. J-Lo will say, she will tell you that when you get the face that you're born with, and then when you're older, you get the face that you deserve. And she doesn't drink or she doesn't like smoke, and so that's the face that she deserves.
Yeah,
so
she looks great.
All I have to do is put the Kirkland wind down, and then maybe I'll look like J-Lo. maybe not. I don't know.
I always imagine, I don't really know, but I imagine that a lot of those actors work out a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. You're probably right. And do like weird diets and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that.
It's their job to look good. So, you know.
Right.
They
right.
They probably
yeah.
spend a lot of time at it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If we had the time, we would look that good too.
Oh, for sure. I mean, well, I do believe that I do look a good.
Oh, but, yeah. You look great.
But yeah. Oh, and Beth, like, shout out to you. Like, I was looking at your butt the other day, like, whoa. Whoa. You got it, girl. You got it, girl.
Why, thank you. Thank you for looking at my butt.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You have a good butt for a white lady.
So how you doing?
I'm doing good. You and I went to the movies, but the day before I went to the movies with my daughter and we saw Angry Birds, and they demanded to check my bag, and as they did when you and I went. And I was like, what? Are you only checking black people's bags? Like, I was like, ready to like call out the racism. And the guy, his face got so red and he was like, no. It's just because the Black Knight movie came out yesterday, or the Joker movie. And we're just trying to be cautious. And then I was like, okay, let's go, sweetie. Thanks, dude, for not being racist. Bye. I told my husband the story. He was like, I'm so glad I was not with you guys. So now we are, let me find the mailbag here.
Call the angels. Angels.
Yes, let's call the angels up. And
oh, there they are.
Hello. Time.
Hello, angels.
So what do you got for us, Beth?
Well, I got a review. Surfwatch on Apple Podcasts wrote a review titled Fun, Compassionate, and Real. I love these gals so much. They share the stories that deserve to be heard for the sake of the victims who are ignored by mainstream media. And they have such a great dynamic with each other. Mahalo, is that how you pronounce that?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Thank you. In Hawaiian.
Ah, mahalo to Wendy and Beth, to all you do to teach listeners about how race, gender, class, and sexuality function in these invisible crimes.
Invisible was quote unquote.
Yes.
They're not invisible.
They're not invisible.
We see them in our community. They're just not reported on.
Yes.
And Hip Hop Air Horn, here we go. Yes.
All right. Surfwatch. Thank you, Surfwatch.
Thank you so much. I am going to read a letter from Paul on Facebook. He said, I just listened to the Chris Dorner Part 1 episode. I'm just in utter awe. It was a blistering, passionate run through being black in America. Oh, yes. Shocking and powerful. You really set out clearly how the system, quote unquote, works, just why the N-word just cannot be used by people who don't share its history. Insanity and injustice of the LAPD, what I call the biggest gang in America, and the Rodney King and OJ stories, white America's need for the slap in the face of the OJ trial. And you did being damned funny too. Oh, thank you. I have no training in comedy. I'm just a black person and I'm trying to like not cry every day. Talking of Talking of being funny and slaps, the episode also had the best prayer I've ever heard. Give me the strength not to slap a bitch. Yes. That is on my daily prayer list. I LOL so hard. One love to you. You got the power. Beautiful. Thank you. And you, Sir Paul, are going to be getting some hip hop air horns. Get ready.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul.
You deserve them. You deserve them.
So we're working on some bonus episodes for our patrons. But as you guys know, we're super busy and we have one recorded and it's not quite out of the can yet. We'll be posting that soon, hopefully. And but we wanted to reward our patrons who have been so patient waiting for bonus episodes. So what we decided to do is have a drawing once a month for our patrons. Mm. So everybody who is a patron in the month mm-hmm. will get their name in the drawing and then we'll pull mm-hmm. a name and somebody will win some merch. So yeah, I just wanted to make sure our patrons get rewarded, even though we can't get a lot of bonus episodes. Like some podcasts have tons of bonus episodes because they don't have other jobs.
Other jobs or children or grandkids. Yeah. Let's call it what it is. They're all dudes.
Oh, well, a lot of the women too.
Oh,
and they have a lot of bonus episodes, and I'm always so jealous because I would love to do lots of bonus episodes, but that's their job, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We can't afford to do that yet. So yeah.
So
hopefully.
Stick with us. Yeah, we're trying.
Yeah, we're trying.
So are we just gonna draw random patrons' names?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Now we're gonna take a quick break and get into the story when we come back.
The future of the Negro in this country is precisely as bright or as dark as the future of the country. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place.
Welcome to Wild Black, a podcast all about the struggles of life while black.
Authorities have released dash cam video revealing the chilling moments that led to a police officer shooting and killing Philando Castile.
The only place racism doesn't exist is Fox News and the police department.
Stop. I'm telling you to stop and I'm not going to tell you again.
And what will you do if I don't stop?
I will detain you.
All I'm asking is what unit.
But you're not, I don't need to tell you that information, ma'am.
If you want to come into my building.
It's not your building. You're not the owner.
Here's the thing. The most dangerous place for black people to live is in white people's imagination. In white people's imagination.
Plus all the dopeness in life while black.
Our culture is just so vibrant. And that's why people are so drawn to us. This is who we are as a people. We're just some of the most powerful beings.
My husband was a math teacher for many, many years. He doesn't teach the Pythagorean theorem. He teaches the so-called Pythagorean theorem because Pythagoras went to Egypt to learn that.
This race and culture of people runs the gamut. From the lightest of the light to the darkest of the dark, we got all flavors. There's power in this skin. And if it wasn't so much power in this skin, they wouldn't be trying so hard to kill us.
Mixes it with a little humor.
In order to get McDonald's from your parents when you was a little shorty, what must you have?
You got some McDonald's money?
Damn, that's absolutely. It. Boom.
Do you
boom.
Got some McDonald's
official. You
money.
Got some McDonald's money? You got a McDonald's job?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
When it comes to your grits, brother, do you do salt or sugar?
Sugar. That's the only way, man. I'm from Arkansas. I'm a country boy.
Oh, man.
We put sugar in everything.
Just to remind us how powerful we are.
It's something about being on a talented underdog team. The score is 450 years to zero.
Do yourself and your culture a favor and go check us out on any podcast platform. Peace.
Welcome to Wild Black, a seriously opinionated podcast.
So, Beth, who are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about Craig Price, also known as the Warwick Slasher. He was a juvenile serial killer who committed his crimes in Warwick, Rhode Island, between the ages of 13 and 15.
So he was a baby.
Yeah.
So Craig Price, now we're going to get into the stats, which is Wendy's favorite part of the story. Hey! And he didn't shoot anybody, but I just like the sound effect. Anyway, Craig Price, aka the Warwick Slasher, aka Iron Man, was born on October 11th, 1973. He was 13 years old when he committed his first murder. He was a black boy, and he had four victims. The murders took place in 1987 and in 1989. His victims were, let's pick their names, rest in power, y'all, Rebecca Spencer, she was 27, Joan Heaton, 39, and her daughters, Jennifer, who was 10, and Melissa, who was 8. His MO was stabbing with a knife, and these all occurred in Warwick, Rhode Island. He was a juvenile when he was sentenced, so initially he was set to get out when he was 21, but eventually, due to circumstances and things that occurred in jail, or in prison, actually, he ended up serving a longer term, and I think he's still there now.
Yep.
So, now we are going to dive into the setting. So, take us there, Beth.
The setting is Warwick, Rhode Island in the 1980s. Warwick is the second largest city in Rhode Island and is located approximately 12 miles south of Providence, Rhode Island, 63 miles southwest of Boston, Massachusetts, and 171 miles northeast of New York City.
Still don't know where it is, but thanks. Rhode Island is part of New England. Beginning in the New England colonies, the name New England refers to the six states in the northeastern United States: Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. New Englanders hold a strong regional identity and a distinct history and culture within the United States.
Another term to refer to those who live in New England is Yankee, which was originally used to describe New Englanders with ancestral roots to original English settlers. The term has since evolved throughout American history to have different meanings. People from other countries might describe all Americans as Yankees, or people from the South might describe anyone from the North as Yankees.
In 1620, Puritan separatist pilgrims from England established Plymouth Colony. 10 years later, more Puritans established the Massachusetts Bay Colony. In 1692, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, that's not true at all. Don't listen to me. Don't fact check me ever. The town of Salem, Massachusetts, and surrounding areas experienced the Salem witch trials, one of the most infamous cases of mass hysteria in history.
Yeah, crazy story.
It's crazy what happens when white guys when white guys lose their mind. Yeah.
No joke, man. In the late 18th century, political leaders from the New England colonies initiated resistance to Britain's taxing of the colonists. Residents of Rhode Island captured and burned a British ship.
Oh.
And residents of Boston threw British tea into the harbor during what is now called the Boston Tea Party. Sounds so happy.
Okay, you guys need to have a seat. Britain responded with a series of punitive laws, and confrontations led to the first battles of the American Revolutionary War in 1775, and the expulsion of the British authorities from the region in 1776, just a year later. The region also played a predominant role in the movement to abolish slavery in the United States and was the first region of the U.S. transformed by the Industrial Revolution.
New Englanders have a strong sense of cultural identity.
Boy, do they.
Although this identity has a lot of contradictions, combining Puritanism with liberalism, agrarian life with industry, and isolation with immigration. And I have to say that New England is a beautiful place. It's gorgeous with a lot of history. And autumn in New England is the best.
Okay.
Yeah, the leaves turn all kinds of different colors. Like in some places, like my sister, when she moved to Canada, she expected the winter to be like New England, where, you know, the leaves turn orange and red and yellow, and but their leaves turn like yellow and then just fall off.
Okay.
So it's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
And I've mentioned this before. I lived in Connecticut as a teenager. I'm white, but as a transplant from another area, even I had a difficult time fitting in. My family used to joke about how if you didn't come over on the Mayflower, you were ostracized. Mm. And I can only imagine what it must be like for Black people in that area. It has to be like 100 mm-hmm. times worse. Mm-hmm. There's a population of Blacks in Connecticut, but they are mostly in urban areas. Near us, that was Bridgeport, Connecticut. Mm. Outside of that, in the more rural areas, racism is rampant.
Uh-huh.
I didn't live in Bridgeport, but my feeling was that it was prominent there too. Mm-hmm. And many of the Ivy League schools are located in New England. Yale is in New Haven, Connecticut. Harvard is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brown is in Providence, Rhode Island. So there's kind of a snotty attitude as well.
Well, and all of the, and I think a lot of people don't know this, but a lot of those schools were funded by slavery. Hmm. In fact, I think Georgetown currently has been in the news because it was revealed that they sold a bunch of slaves avoid bankruptcy. And so the descendants of the slaves who were sold are being paid reparations. But each and every one of these Ivy League schools has a hand in slavery. And you guys could go fuck yourselves. What were you going to say, Beth? Sorry.
And also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that a lot of the areas have Native American names like Massachusetts because we took over the place from the Native Americans.
Yep, we did.
Native Americans mm-hmm. are long gone from the area. They were pushed out west.
Yeah.
So it's a picturesque place, but with a dirty underbelly.
Yeah, I have no interest in going to New England anytime soon, unless listeners want us to do a live show. But I have never been there. But my understanding is, as a person of color, that it is not a safe place for people of color. Go to YouTube and see the news footage of the Boston busing protests to see white people's reaction to just having to integrate their schools. These white people lost their fucking minds.
Wow.
And were like open about it on the news. Like, I would be embarrassed to be that hateful on TV.
Yeah.
And here's another reason why. So Joe Biden, good. He's trash. And he made some comments on the subject of busing. And I think it was something like, don't quote me, but it was something like he felt bad or felt terribly for the white mom who had to send her blue-eyed, blonde-haired girl to school with essentially Black animals. And I don't know why you all are still out here supporting Joe Biden. But anyway, it's wild how blatantly racist all of these people were, like, on the news, on TV, and probably many of these people in New England still are. So that's why I will not be going there. Anyway, so now we're going to get into the killer's early life. So hit it, Beth. Boom.
Craig Chandler Price was born on October 11th, 1973, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the third child of John and Shirley Price. John and Shirley, devout Baptists, met in 1967 through their church. Their families were close, and the two sang in the same choir. They married in 1968. In the late 80s, Shirley was a clerical worker, and she also had a second job at Kmart. John was a manager at Pepsi Cola Company in Cranston.
So both parents were present. They
yep.
both had jobs. Mm-hmm.
Responsible, upstanding citizens.
Yeah, yeah. But he was the third kid. Nobody cares about the third kid. So
the third kid is the baby, man. It's the middle kid nobody gives a shit about.
Jan. Beth.
Yeah,
Beth, personal experience.
I'm Jan.
Personal experience.
Yes.
Okay. I always was envious of my youngest brother because he could get away with anything.
Yeah.
I think my mom wrote like a lot of his papers for school.
Oh, wow.
like filled out all his job applications. Like,
my sister was the youngest and she could get away with a lot too. But I think by the time she came along, you know, it's not the parents' fault. By the time she came along, they were probably just tired. They're like, whatever,
They were tired. Yeah, exactly. So every young, I think birth order is really important.
It is.
And I think it is really telling when you meet somebody who's either an oldest or a middle child or the youngest one. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I know if I'm working with a person who's the youngest, they're going to expect me to do all the work. Yes. Yeah. And a middle child is like super drama. Like, you know what I mean? These things are not things. They're real.
But yeah, it's true. But birth orders can get messed up. Like in my family, my brother was the oldest, but he usually the oldest is the most responsible. But yeah. he's like the least responsible. So he like abdicated his role. So I kind of slipped into the oldest kid role. So I'm not like a typical middle kid. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, okay. I see you, boo.
And also if there's a whole bunch of kids or a gap in between ages, yeah. then the birth order, like if the family has like three kids and then they go 5 years and then have another three kids, the birth order starts over again.
Mm, yes.
So like the fourth kid is going to be like the oldest kid.
Yes. Yes. I see what you mean. And I don't disagree.
So anyway, where were we? Oh, Craig was little. Craig. Yeah.
Did you ever see the movie Friday?
Yes.
Okay. You get to lie, Craig. So when Craig was little, he often made his parents laugh, and Shirley Price called him a little jokester. He was described by some as accident prone, always running around, sometimes not watching where he was, what he was doing. He slipped unnoticed out of the house at age 3, and he was hit by a car and injured his leg.
Yikes.
I don't know how CPS stepped in immediately. He had stitches when he was about 7. After being hit on the head with a rock, and a year or two later, he fell off a chair and broke his collarbone.
That doesn't sound too bad. I mean, he's a boy and, you know, running around and, you know, he got hurt a few times, so.
Yeah, I mean, having a little boys are, they just get hurt all the time.
Yeah.
It's fucking
so that doesn't
crazy.
Sound too bad, yeah. In 1978, the Price family moved to the Buttonwoods neighborhood of Warwick. The Prices chose the city for its public schools. Mm. Craig loved football and baseball and playing electric guitar. He was good at sports and didn't care if he won or lost. Ooh. He liked hard rock and rap music. He was a storyteller, and he was described as a big marshmallow and always surrounded by friends. He could be a wise guy around the authorities, but was respectful to grown-ups in the neighborhood. He often offered to shovel snow or cut grass for his neighbors.
Seems like a great guy.
Yeah.
A great little boy.
So far?
Yeah. yeah. Things change. According to Craig, when he was 8 or 9, he was racing on bicycles with some other kids in the neighborhood when some older kids showed up, called him racial epithets, and threw golf balls at him. They accused him of stealing the bike he was riding, which was his prized possession. When they left, Craig says that the group threatened him with the car they were in, and he crashed his bike into a curb. At that point, Price wanted those kids to die. And I feel like it needs to be said that somebody calling you the N-word or telling you that your hair is messy or your skin is dirty or whatever, racism is, I think, violent, and you don't have to necessarily string somebody up by a tree to injure them. The words are enough.
Yeah,
that's all.
And they were terrorizing him,
right?
Threatening him with the car and all that. You know, mm-hmm. It's scary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's 8 or 9 years old. That's fucked up.
Absolutely.
So he picked up his broken bike and he went home. His father was mad about the damage to his bike. Craig tried to tell him what happened, but he wasn't supposed to be racing, so he got in trouble and he got a spanking. Price later said that he got over the spanking, but he never shed the feeling of injustice.
Oh, I remember every single racist thing that has happened to me in my entire life.
Wow.
It makes it very difficult to sleep.
Yeah.
Anyway, his teachers at his high school thought he was smart, but that he didn't try. At 15, he tested above his grade level in reading and spelling, but he cut class and he had to repeat a grade. He began dabbling in drugs, doing drugs, and petty theft. He argued with his parents, threatened his sister, wound up in juvenile court, and was out on probation.
While Craig had some problems, as we mentioned, he was a member of an intact working class family. But Price later said that he didn't develop an outlet for his anger when he was a child and, quote, maybe that anger grew in an unnatural way, unquote.
Hmm.
Price traces the seeds of this anger to racism.
And not condoning anything that he did, but I certainly can understand it.
Yeah.
One day while he was playing football with his brother and some other kids in the street outside of his house, Craig Price says that he heard a racial slur. And I want to describe what it sounds like to hear a racial slur. Your brow gets sweaty. You're not exactly sure what happened to you. Your hands get sweaty. You get tense. There is a sense of fear, and then there's a sense of rage. And it's also crippling because you know you can't do anything about it because you are going to be the one who goes to jail. So it's all of that in a one good salad bowl. It does something to you physiologically. It is almost as if somebody punched you. And there's nothing that I can do about the color of my skin. There's nothing I can do about what I am. I'm a black woman. And so when somebody attacks me, they're doing it verbally, but I experience it physically. It really hurts. And it also sticks with you. Like, I will never forget the first time I realized that I was black when a kid said, can't you clean your skin? Can't you clean that off?
Wow.
You know, and so it is very painful. And so I can totally understand how the Warwick slasher was angry. But I'm not condoning anything that he did, but I just understand the pain
anger
that
yeah.
he felt, the pain and the anger that he felt.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to kill anybody. Don't worry. So Craig Price said that he heard a racial slur in a man's voice coming from a car stopped in front of Becky Spencer's house. Price later said that he didn't do anything, but just like many times before, he grew angry and outraged. He stuffed it inside, but he said the anger wouldn't fit. He couldn't, he didn't know what to do with it. And his inability to cope with the anger left him with a strong desire to murder. So now we're going to dive into the timeline. So what do you got for us, Beth?
Becky Spencer, her children, Stephen, who was 8, and Danielle, 4, and her brother, Carl Batty, shared a house, but they were moving. Most of the furniture had already been moved, and the house was filled with cardboard boxes. Now divorced and in her late 20s, Becky had earned her GED the year before and planned to go to college.
You better call Becky with the good hair. I'm not, I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. On July 27th in 1987, Becky's kids were at their father's and she spent the day packing and running errands. A girlfriend of Becky's came over to help pack. And that afternoon, the woman ran errands. In the evening, Carl, a security guard, joined Becky and her friend at dinner before he headed to work on an all-night shift. The women started packing.
That same evening, 13-year-old Craig Price joined the neighborhood kids for a hide-and-seek game with teams that they called Manhunt.
Hmm.
I don't know if this is a
I've never played
popular
that game.
I remember playing a game like this, but I don't remember what we called it, but it wasn't Manhunt. But anyway, the game stretched across the street in driveways and backyards, over fences and under shrubs. Throughout the game, Price and a friend were smoking marijuana. And I read in a lot of different places that he was heavily into smoking pot.
Well, as somebody who is an advocate for pot, it mostly makes you just happy.
Yeah, you
and relax.
Yeah, but I think at that age, 13 years old, it can fuck with your head.
Yeah.
To do anything that alters your perception of reality. So we'll get into it on takeaways, I guess. But I wonder how much drugs had to do with the choices that he made.
Interesting perspective from the white lady. Burr, burr, burr. So, sorry, I don't mean to call you out like that. You're a wonderful man. You're not like most white ladies. You're a good one. You're on my favorite white lady list, along with Julia Stiles. Anyway, at one point, a car coming down the street interrupted the game. In a statement to police the next day, one of the kids said that the man driving the car hollered at them about being in the street and that he made some comment that they could get run over next time.
But Craig Price later told police that the driver had blared his horn at the kids and that Price had seen the man at Becky Spencer's house about a week earlier. Years later, Price would allege that the driver was the one who made the racial remark that Price had heard the prior week. On the night of the manhunt game, Price says, the man rolled down his window and called Price a racial slur.
I can only imagine what that word was, but I digress. Yeah. At about 9 p.m., a man that Becky's friend was dating stopped at Becky's house. He later told police that he had noticed a bunch of kids playing in front of Becky's house when he had pulled up. But his statement does not say what he said to them.
At about 9:30 p.m., the trio went out for ice cream, ran a couple of errands, and then Becky's friend and her boyfriend brought Becky home. It was nearly midnight when Becky's friends left. Becky Spencer changed into pajamas and then lay down under a blanket on the living room floor since her bed had been moved already. She fell asleep to music videos on VH1.
Oh my God, love VH1. Anyway, Craig Price was home in his room. His father was working a night shift. His sister was staying with friends, and his mother and brother were asleep. Price, dressed in black, snuck out of the house and headed towards Becky's house, two doors down.
He hopped a couple of fences and then dropped into Becky Spencer's backyard. The house was quiet and the only light was a dim flickering from Becky's television. Price peered into a window. He could see a figure under a blue blanket, lying on the carpet in a room with no furniture.
Price broke into Becky's house and then attacked her with a packing knife that he found there. Price stabbed Becky until she stopped moving. A total of 58 times. A total of 58 stabbings.
Yeah.
He then ran from Spencer's home. When he got to the fence and tried to climb it, he saw that he still held the knife and he flung it and ran.
Back at his room, he shed his bloody clothes, stuffed it into a bag, and hid it in the attic. Then he washed up. Later, Price said that he felt clever for getting away with the murder, but he made sure to behave like everyone else in the neighborhood, terrified about a killer walking their streets.
2 years later, in August of 1989, when Price was 15. So you got to imagine, like, he's going to school.
Yeah,
like,
he's doing all the usual things, arguing with his parents.
Yeah.
And
yeah. All the like, usual no big stuff. Deal. Like, yeah. I did kill somebody, but yeah. big whoop.
Got to get to football practice.
Got to do that algebra homework. He says he met Heaton and her daughters as he walked through their Warwick neighborhood. The family was out for a bike ride and offered to fix a chain that had slipped off of one of the girls' bikes. As he fixed the chain, Price believed that he sensed an aura of racial bigotry. I am familiar with that sentiment, so I can't disrespect it. From Heaton, and he interpreted the girls' giggling as similarly rooted in the same perceived racism. Sometimes it's challenging sort of navigating this life as a black person, because you don't me as a Black woman, I sometimes don't know if people are being assholes because I'm Black. I don't know if they're being assholes because I'm a woman.
Or they're just being assholes.
Or they're just being assholes. So it's like, oh, I am, my brain is so tired. Anyway, continue.
A few days later, Price claims to have noticed Heaton eyeing him from her window as he was walking home. What Price perceived as Heaton's contemptuous racism spun him into an absolute dark rage. Then a solution came to him. Quote, kill her. I knew the act of killing Joan Heaton was the answer. Unquote.
All right. Well, on September 1st, 1989, Price again snuck out of his parents' house and through the neighborhood, this time towards Joan Heaton's home, one street away. He climbed through a window and accidentally broke a table sitting under it. Joan Heaton walked out of her bedroom.
According to Price, quote, she seen me, then she kind of act like she didn't see me, turned around and started to run like back towards her room that way or towards her kids, unquote. Price tackled her. In the chaos, he said the kids woke up and their mother screamed for them to call for help. Quote, she was just saying that, get to the phone, unquote. Asked if either of the girls did so, he said, quote, nah, the daughter was just standing against the side of the wall, unquote.
Have you ever talked about your kids in the event that somebody breaks into their house or like your house?
Don't recall if I did when they were little. I don't think so. I think I didn't want to scare them.
Well, my kids know that I'm super into true crime. So I'm always like, go across the street. Go across the street. If somebody breaks in our house, go across the street and tell our neighbors.
Get the neighbors,
to call for
yeah.
Help. Yeah, get the neighbors. But man, I just feel really bad for these little girls. They had no idea what to do and they had no idea what's coming.
Yeah. I mean, even if you tell them what to do, it's still in that moment, they might not remember, you know?
Oh, I know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Poor little things.
Yeah, these poor little girls. Price said Mrs. Heaton fought back. He said, she bit me and I bit her back. Price said he ran to the kitchen and pulled knives from a block in the kitchen. He estimated that he used about 6 knives in the killing because they kept breaking. And I heard one account said the knives were breaking off in these people's bodies.
Yeah. During the struggle, Price cut his finger. Detectives would later find drops of blood throughout the house that they believed came from the killer. But Price said that his biggest concern that night was whether the police were on the way.
Afterward, Price said he took a towel from the bathroom and attempted to clean up, but stopped and turned his attention to getting the murder weapons out of the house. He took a garbage bag from the bathroom and put everything in it. Before leaving, Price covered Joan Heaton's body with a blanket and the two girls with a rug. Asked why, Price said, I couldn't look at that. I wonder what that says about the kind of guy he was.
They usually say that if they cover them up, then they're actually ashamed.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's okay. What the FBI says. Those FBI profilers.
Those racist FBI profilers.
It sounds like it, though, because he said, I couldn't look at that, so... That's what it sounds like.
It does kind of sound like that. Yeah.
39-year-old Heaton's body exhibited 11 stab wounds to the chest, face, and neck, rib and skull fractures, and numerous injuries from blunt trauma. The body of her daughter, fifth grader Melissa Heaton, displayed 7 stab wounds and evidence of having been similarly beaten. Jennifer Heaton, 2 years younger than her sister Melissa, was also found dead. She had been stabbed 62 times and her skull had been fractured.
I'm just wondering why the baby was so...
Yeah, I don't know.
Like her murder was so much more brutal than the other one.
62 times and fractured her head. I don't know.
I mean, like, think of... Okay, I have a 7-year-old and I have a 4-year-old. And like... How much surface area? Like, their bodies are small.
Yeah, not a lot of surface area. Like
62 times, but in the same.
That's like her whole body.
Hell.
Yeah.
Yes. So now we're going to get into the investigation and arrest. Man, this case has me feeling a type of way. So found at the Heaton residence were a bloody handprint, bloodstains in areas away from the bodies, and Band-Aid wrappers on the floor. Because of this, investigators believe that the killer had been cut during the attack. Warwick police officers and FBI agents began investigating the Heaton murders, keeping their eyes open for suspects with lacerations to the hand. And why was the FBI involved so fast? Was it because these were white ladies?
I don't know. They called them in. Not sure why. But yeah, it could be because they were white. Don't know.
Okay.
Or it could be because they were children. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the rules. I'm not. Don't fact check me. I don't know.
I think the police have to ask them in, and maybe they felt over their heads. I don't know.
Okay.
But anyway, police believe that Heaton's murderer was somebody from the neighborhood and that the crime was connected to Becky Spencer's murder. While patrolling Metropolitan Drive in Warwick, two police officers saw Price walking down the street. One of the officers was familiar with him because he coached him in basketball, so the officer stopped to talk to him.
While talking, they noticed a bandage on his finger. When asked about it, Price told them that he had gotten drunk a few nights earlier and punched a car window, breaking it. But the officers thought it was strange that he would so openly admit to doing something illegal. They decided that they needed to at least check the story and found that there was no police report of a broken car window in the neighborhood to corroborate it, and there was no broken glass anywhere.
Yeah. Price then became a suspect in the Heaton murders. Investigators went to Craig's house and asked him to come with his parents to the police station, which they did. During questioning, Craig was asked more detailed questions about how he had cut his hand. He maintained his story about how he hurt himself, but investigators were not convinced and asked him to take a polygraph.
So the following day, Craig submitted to a polygraph and he was asked questions related to how he cut his motherfucking hand. And the test indicated that Craig was lying, but that did not prove that he was involved in the murders. No. Investigators indeed needed more evidence.
So on September 17th, 1989, police searched the Price home. While searching a shed behind the house, a trash bag was found full of incriminating evidence. Within the bag were several bloody knives from the Heaton household, along with bloodied articles of clothing, gloves, and other objects. Investigators arrested Price for the murders of Joan, Jennifer, and Melissa Heaton.
Craig was taken to the police station with his parents. He was booked, then interrogated about the murders. Police were shocked when Price immediately confessed to the Heaton murders. He claimed that he had just intended to burglarize the home, of course, but that Joan had caught him, and in a panic, he killed her. The children, hearing the noise, woke up, and then he killed them too.
Craig's father was so upset, he went to the bathroom, threw up, and did not return to the interview room. His mother, Shirley, sat behind him, quietly crying. Asked if he also committed the Spencer murder, Price initially denied it.
Craig told the investigators that he was glad, quote unquote, that he got caught for the Heaton murders, but that he wasn't the killer in the other case. But hours later, under questioning, Price confessed to that as well. According to law enforcement officials, Price had no remorse when confessing to the murders. So now we're going to dive into the trial. And he was a minor, so there's not much here. What do you got, Beth?
After confessing in 1989, rather than a trial, Price's case was adjudicated in Rhode Island Family Court since he was a juvenile. Adjudication is when a judge listens to the evidence and then makes a decision. There's no jury. Because of the law, Price could not be tried as an adult in criminal court. Price was 15 when he committed the Heaton murders, and the cutoff was 16.
I wonder if he were to face a jury, I think that he probably would have gotten the death penalty.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a big kid.
Yeah, it would have been worse, for sure.
Dark-skinned, black kid, yeah. I'm sure it would have been a white jury, because black people don't fucks with jury duty. And you should, by the way, black people, be on more juries. For more just
do your civic duty
outcomes, but do your civic duty. But I think black people are afraid of being like sort of being on the books,
with
the justice system, and that can be dangerous for people of color to be on the books, if you will. So anyway, Price was found guilty of 2 counts of burglary and 4 counts of murder. The court ordered that Price be held at the Rhode Island Training School until October 11th, 1994. Price's 21st birthday, a sentence of less than 6 years, is when he was supposed to get out. Under state law at the time, they could not give him a longer sentence. So now we're going to get into where are they now? Hit it, Beth.
When Price's public defender learned that the prosecutors were contemplating the possibility of having Price committed to a mental institution, she immediately advised Price not to cooperate with psychiatric personnel, even though he had been court ordered to do so.
Any good defense attorney would have done that. Just saying. In 1993, Price was charged with assault and extortion after allegedly threatening to snuff out a training school correctional officer. Price was found guilty by jury verdict and received a 15-year sentence. Price also continued to defy repeated court orders to undergo psychiatric evaluations. Rhode Island Attorney General Jeffrey Pine, I'm sure he's a white guy, urged the court to hold Price in contempt for his ongoing failure to cooperate. The trial court agreed and imposed a 1-year sentence for civil contempt, which would terminate at any time upon Price's compliance with the court order.
Price finally agreed to undergo psychiatric evaluation, but doctors reported that Price had lied during the sessions about his involvement in the Spencer and Heaton murders. The prosecution then moved to hold Price in criminal contempt, and Price was found guilty by a jury verdict of criminal contempt and sentenced to 25 years. So he got more time for criminal contempt than for murder.
The justice system is obsessed with getting black bodies behind bars. It's ridiculous. A 13-page paper by Alan B. Feinstein, a psychologist for the Department of Corrections. Feinstein wrote that while other factors were present in Price's psyche, years of experiencing both overt and covert forms of racism appear to have had a significant impact on his physiological functioning and ultimate acts of aggression. And the people who are writing the books on psychology are all white men. And so the idea of racism is completely foreign to them. And so I do appreciate that Feinstein wrote this, but he doesn't get it. And I don't think anybody who's a published psychiatrist or psychologist understands the true impact of racism. We need more black and brown people in this field to really
study that and
explain,
yeah, explain
and study it.
Because
I'm telling you, I'm just like sweaty talking just about it, Beth.
Thinking
like,
about it, yeah.
It is, yeah, it's awful. It's awful. Anyway.
Feinstein interviewed Price many times in prison. Throughout the interview process, I was struck by CP's numerous stories of racial mistreatment and the effect they had on him. These events were related in such detail, it was as though they had occurred only yesterday, rather than in some cases over 20 years ago.
Like the time he was 5 and other kids wondered where his tail was, like when other kids were served soda and glasses and he was the only one that, with a paper cup. Interviews conducted with CP indicate that his victims were not chosen at random or as a matter of convenience, but rather due to their being associated with some perceived racial slight directed towards him. And fuck you. It's not perceived. Okay. Beth, and you and I could debate this later, but I don't think it was perceived. So.
Okay.
Good.
On July 29th, 2009, Craig was involved in a prison fight with another inmate. While trying to break up the fight, one of the correctional officers was stabbed in the finger by a handmade shank in Price's possession. After the prison fight, Price was transferred to another facility.
Price was denied parole in March 2009, and his release date was set for May 2020. All right. But on April 4th, 2017, Price attacked a fellow inmate named Joshua Davis with a handmade knife at the Suwanee Correctional Institution in Live Oak, Florida.
Price pleaded guilty to attempted murder and contraband in prison, and on January 18, 2019, he was sentenced to another 25 years. Under Florida law, Price will have to serve at least 80% of that sentence, or 21 years, for that crime, and he's been classified as a habitual felony offender.
I got lots of feelings about that. So now we're going to get into what we think made him snap, as well as our takeaways. So what do you think about this case,
Beth? Well, obviously racism played a big role, as we talked about, and his inability to deal with his anger. He also, to me, seemed to have somewhat of a paranoid personality. There's no doubt at all that he dealt with racism in his lifetime. I mean, obviously. But if the story about how he met Joan Heaton and daughters is true, which we don't know because this story came from Price, so we don't even know if that story is true. I sometimes think that he's not a reliable narrator.
You might be right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if that story's true, he perceived racism coming from them when it's possible that there wasn't any. The girls giggling made him think that they were racist. Joan looking at him out of her window, he perceived as racist. They didn't do anything overtly racist. And that's not to say that it's not at all possible that his perception of racism was incorrect. It's possible. Mm-hmm. But it's also possible that the girls were giggling because they didn't know him and Joan was just looking out of her window. When I take my dog for a walk in the neighborhood and I see a man walking towards me, I move to the other side of the street. And if that man happens to be Black, I could see that he might think that I'm being racist, but I'm just moving to the other side of the street because he's a man. And, sometimes I do worry about that, you know, that I think about it. It's like, oh, he's Black, maybe I should stay here. But no, if he was white, I'd move over to the other side of the street.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm moving over to the other side of the street. Yeah. And you know, I had a psychologist one time who told me you can't really control what other people think, you know, like we were talking about relationships and stuff like that. So this story is more about that kind of a thing. Like you could walk into a room full of people and the guy across the room could think that he's in love with you and you did nothing, you know? Huh. And you know, it's just a perception that all of a sudden he's in love with you and he starts stalking you, and there's nothing that you did, nothing that you didn't encourage it or whatever. It's just his perception, right, is that he's in love with you, and
right.
I have to say I do worry about that. Like I don't want anybody to think I'm being racist by looking at them out my window or something, you know, but they might.
I think the looking out the window is not a thing. But if you're looking out your window and then you're calling 911 or like,
niggers
are in my neighborhood again.
But
that's very racist.
Yes, of course, that's overtly racist. But he said she was looking out the window at him, and he decided that she was racist.
I gotta say though, growing up in a very white, I didn't grow up, I went to high school in, again, Spokane, which I will always say Spokane is fucking racist and I hate that fucking town. That's why I won't go see my mom anymore. But anyway, it is very racist, and you see people opening their windows looking at what you're doing, or like we had one neighbor come over and was like, so are you guys renting? I was like, no, motherfucker, my parents bought this goddamn house, get out of my face.
Yeah. And there's other things you can do, like somebody looking out the window and then she clutches her pearls and or
right,
gives you a dirty look or something like that, you know. It happens.
And we've also talked about too how white people don't realize that they're being racist sometimes. And so that woman looking out the window, she might not have like she might have maybe have felt uncomfortable with a black person in her neighborhood walking down the street, and wanted to look and see. But she might, that might have been unconscious racism,
yeah,
right? Like, there's a black person. That's weird. That shouldn't be in my white space.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. But the other thing that he did that made me think that maybe he was not such a reliable narrator was when he talked about the guy in the car who yelled a racial slur at him when they were all playing in the street.
Mm-hmm.
None of the other kids said that he did that. He's the only one who said that he did that. They all said that he was yelling at them to get out of the street. You know, maybe he did yell a racial slur at him, but
yeah,
maybe it didn't, you know. It just makes me think maybe he's not such a reliable narrator.
The story.
Yes, the story. Yeah. And that's not to say that somebody didn't yell racial slurs at him at some point or another, because yeah, definitely it happened, but maybe not that day. I don't know.
I don't know either, but you know how everybody's like, believe women. I'm like, believe kids who say that something racist has happened to them.
Yeah.
So, but I've started my own practice of acting like I'm super afraid of white ladies. And I lock my doors and I grab my purse when they're around.
Clutch your pearls and give them dirty looks.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, like, oh my God.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my God. Lock the doors. Everybody. Oh, white lady. Nini. My daughter. Don't look at them. Don't look at them in the eyes. And I only say that to say, I think that racism could really make people snap. Like, it really causes, all throughout this episode, a lot of problems, including PTSD, on like a cellular level. Like, as a person of color, as a non-white person, you just feel the stuff.
And you got to worry about it all the time.
You got to worry about it all the time. Because again, I'm never sure. I'm never 100% sure if somebody's treating me some way because I'm a woman or because I'm black or because you just never know. The only ones who get to move about freely are straight, cisgender white dudes. Like, they don't think about this shit ever. And boy, oh boy, it must be nice. But I'd like to interrogate the justice system in this case.
Oh,
because we've talked about the adultization of black kids before how kids of color are, whatever bad things happen to them are their fault. And at a young age, they're treated, as far as the justice system is concerned, like adults.
Right.
Kids are not. And so this killer was very young, and juveniles, I think, should be released at some point, right? That's I think
they should get treatment, and that should be the goal. Get them treatment and get them released. Yes.
Civilized citizens. But the justice system just didn't want to let this young black boy go at all costs.
Yeah.
It seemed like at every turn he was about to get released, like they were like,
there was actually people who formed a group, and I forget
what
in the same?
It was a bunch of white ladies.
I don't remember who all was involved, but I think one of the cops was involved and some other people, and their whole goal was to keep him in prison for the rest of his life
and in jail rest of his life. And I know that he killed, but he was a child when he did it.
Yeah, and like I said, he was doing drugs, and I think that fucks up your brain when you're that young.
But it was just pot.
Yeah, but I think it fucks up your brain when you're that young.
Agree to disagree.
Okay. I just think anything that alters your perceptions is going to fuck you up when you're still growing, your brain's still growing, you're still learning about the world. You're not looking through a clear glass, you know? It's fogged.
Yeah, I can totally see your point. I don't fucks with it. That's all. It just seemed, it seemed ruthless that the justice system was like, no, we got a black guy, a black child in jail, and we are going to keep him there for fucking ever.
And I think, obviously, part of the problem was that he was
big.
Yeah, he was a big black guy. He was like 300 pounds, I think. Dark. Yeah. So they were scared of him. But I think his attorney did him a disservice by telling him not to cooperate with getting psychological help.
You know what? I'm going to agree with you on that one. Yeah, because I think it might have helped. Yeah, maybe even he would have had an opportunity to like get the treatment that he needed and maybe get out. And I don't know, maybe he could have had led a really like productive, successful life. So I don't know.
But like you said, any good defense attorney probably would have advised the same thing, because we talked about this in another episode, the Hawaiian guy who was in a mental institution. Once you get in the mental institution, it's really hard to get out. So I imagine that's why he was advised not to cooperate. But I think it was a real disservice to him as a person, even if he was stuck in the mental institution for a long time, maybe he would have gotten some help. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we will never know.
Yeah.
So, if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips.
So this tip is from Zeke via email. A good tip for people with sliding windows that either don't have locks or the lock is broken or need to leave a window cracked for some reason or another, you can use a piece of 1x1 or any piece of wood cut to the length of the other window, and then you put it into the track of the window that slides so it can't be opened any further. And anyway, hope it's helpful and you haven't already mentioned it. We have not. And on both of my kids' windows, we do have a piece of wood in the track so that nobody can break into our house and steal our kids.
They can only open the window just a little crack. I actually have a piece of metal pipe in the track of my sliding window. I found it in my garage and it was the perfect size. So I just stuck it in there. Hey. Yeah. So thank you, Zeke, for the tip.
Yeah, no.
And if anybody else wants to send us some tips to read on episodes, have at it.
Yes, we love it. We love it. And we love you. So now we're going to get into some serial killer and true crime news. Extra, extra, read all about it. So me and Beth both have some thoughts on this. But so there was a 9-year-old girl who turns out that she's actually 22 years old. What? Natalia, the quote-unquote child, has a form of dwarfism. Natalia tried to kill her parents by putting bleach in her mom's coffee. I just think that's so funny. The child had full pubic hair when they tried to give her a bath. The child used sophisticated language, and she claimed to be Ukrainian but didn't understand Ukrainian language. A bone density test confirmed the girl was at least 14. Natalia attacked a baby boy, and this was all captured on baby monitoring technology. She smeared bodily fluids on the walls, and she would stand over her parents in the evening with knives. She tried to drag her mother towards an electric fence at one point. She was treated for mental health, and then she was sent to a psychiatric institution. She was released by her adoptive parents, and they took care of her for years. They found places for her to live, and when she wasn't living with her parents, they were like, look, you fucking crazy, we're just gonna get you an apartment and we'll pay for it, just please stay the fuck away from us. So they like financed her living expenses and stuff and pay for an apartment for her, and then her parents were like, we're going to Canada. And didn't tell her. And they left Natalia and lost contact with her. And eventually, Natalia, the quote-unquote child, went to the Canadian officials and was like, my parents abandoned me. How dare they? And the courts ended up proving, I guess, that Natalia was not a child. But now the state of Indiana is charging her two parents, and they actually went to jail for harming a child. And also in other news, Amber Geiger, that racist white cop who shot that black man in his apartment, has gone to jail. So what do you got?
So about the story about Natalia. So what I read was that they actually don't know the whole story yet, that she's either 30 or 16, depending on what documents you believe. The Barnetts, okay, the adoptive parents, had the girl's Ukrainian birth records, and they indicated the girl was born in 2003. They had them changed to make her an adult, but the attorneys who represented her in a guardianship case believe that she is a minor. The information about the pubic hair, the menstrual cycles, and mental health disorders came from Christine Barnett, the adopted mother. Her ex-husband did not back her up. Officials have called the claims into question, and police say that the bone density test carried out on Natalia in 2010 actually showed that Natalia was 8 years old then, and that in 2012, tests showed that she was around 11. A year after changing their adoptive daughter's birth records, the Barnetts rented an apartment for the girl in Lafayette and moved her there.
Lafayette.
A month after that, the rest of the Barnett family moved to Canada, so Michael and Christine Barnett's oldest son could study at a special school for smart people. Police say that in 2013 to 2016, the Barnetts did not support Natalia financially while she lived alone in the apartment in Lafayette, and they lived in Canada. Another family has since taken the girl in, and reportedly they have not had the problems that the Barnetts claim to have had with her. They are attempting to get the girl's birth records changed back. According to the prosecutor's probable cause affidavit, the charge against the adoptive parents came after Michael Barnett told investigators that they knew the girl was not an adult when they left her in Lafayette. So it's a pretty interesting case. I'm not citing exactly one way or the other yet. I'm waiting for more information to come out. I do kind of think it was a dick move to leave the girl like that, especially if she had all those mental problems that they claim that she did. They could have provided more help for her rather than just leaving her. I don't know. And I immediately didn't like the lady.
Oh, agree to disagree. I feel like the parents are victims. Also, I was born with pubic hair.
Oh, wow.
And I got my period when I was
eight. Yeah, so there's that.
It's not weird.
Yeah.
And then there's that.
Yeah. Just the looking at the lady's picture, I know that's awful. I just immediately had like a dislike for her. And then I read that she wrote a book about her smart son, and I guess he has a mild case of autism, and she's supposed to be like a parenting expert or something. That immediately made me not like her.
Oh, red flag.
Yeah, that's a red flag to me. It's like, look at me. I'm a parenting expert. My autistic son is a genius. We're going to Canada. Now, I don't know, but that's just my immediate feeling. So
it is kind of suspect, but I think that this is a fascinating story. And
yeah,
so
I can't wait.
When I was working on the talk, I just had to include this. I just thought it was so funny.
I can't wait to find more information about it. I hope that they keep reporting on it. I hope this isn't all we ever hear about it and it just like fades off into the ether. I want to know more about this.
Me too. Same things. So now we are going to get into the shout out portion of our show where we shout out any content by people of color or about people of color or any marginalized groups or any true crime goodies. So I wanted to shout out the Spooked podcast. It is back, y'all, in time for Halloween. And the creator is a Black dude, and they have some of the most terrifying ghost stories that have stuck with me throughout the year. Like I will never forget the story about the lady who was attacked by a raccoon with rabies.
Wow.
I'm sweating thinking about it. So and these stories are told by amazing storytellers. It's great production. They probably have a lot of money behind them. They're not doing it Fulham style. But I binged all of the episodes that are out right now. It's just fantastic.
That's awesome.
It is so scary and so awesome. So
the guy who does Spooked also does a show. His name is Glenn Washington.
Oh.
He also does a show called Snap Judgment, and that's really good too.
Awesome podcast.
Yeah, I used to listen to it on NPR back in the day when I didn't listen to podcasts.
Oh, old school style.
Yeah.
Old white guy style.
Yeah. It was the only show, I think, that was hosted by a person of color on NPR that I knew of.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. Oh, my God. NPR, come on. Do better. But I was with a bunch of old white guys, and they were like, oh, I really enjoy listening to NPR when I'm doing long drives to Tucson. And I was like, you guys haven't heard a podcast? What the fuck is wrong with you? I'm gonna get a shrimp on a stick. I'm out of here. So Spooked. It's so good.
All right.
If you want nightmares.
All right.
So where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download to your phone. Or you can find online at cash.me/$ Fruit Loops Pod. Or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. We also have merch on our website now at fruitloopspod.com/merch.
That's right. Now, this is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there. It really is.
Thank you.